Welcome, everybody, to one of the last sessions of the day, of the conference, actually. I know we're all likely quite tired, but also still quite intrigued by the topic of the day. So I want to welcome all of you and congratulate you on your fortitude for making it this far. I think we're going to get started a little bit early, and we'll try to end on time, if not a little bit early, so then we can all go enjoy drinks by the pool and wish each other goodbye till the next time. We'll start off by saying thank you to IAM and Joff and the whole gang for organizing this. It's been a fabulous conference. I think all of us have really enjoyed it, all the events, all the sessions, being with and talking with all of you in the audience. We have a great panel today. We're going to focus in on really the topic of the day, which is the increasing corporate interest in monetizing or seeing value in the intellectual property, the ability to actually generate cash for the entity today, tomorrow, in the future. Cash for both operating but also enhancing the operational value, the entity value, today and in the future. So before we begin, the only thing the audiovisual assistants did not help us with was how to actually, oh, there we go, how to actually get that to happen. And so away we go. And let's just put this into slideshow view. Okay. Anybody from the beginning? Thank you. All right. And so with that, we want to welcome you formally to Cash is King, a catchy title for, again, focusing in on some of the best practices, which are critical to creating and enhancing value for the entity, for the corporation, even for the individual patentee, patent holder. How do you go about assessing a portfolio? What are some of the best practices related to valuation? There was an interesting phrase that I think Joff and the editors threw in, how to give the other party what they want. So I guess in a way that's how do you motivate the other side of the transaction to move forward on a transaction that you're excited with also. As part of this conversation, we will hopefully touch on how these IP transactions are able to help enhance and add value to the entity from putting more cash on the balance sheet again today and in the future, and some observations on where we think the market might be going. Some of the trends and so forth in IP transactions. I am Robert Aronoff of Pluritas. I'm the moderator. Sitting with us here is Charlie. Charlie will be first up, Vice President and Deputy General Counsel. So, Charlie, I typed it backwards. I apologize. Should be DGC. IP Licensing, Hewlett-Packard Company. Sitting next to Charlie, of course, is Beatrix. Recipient of one of the awards given out last night, Executive Vice President, Intellectual Property and Licensing with Technicolor, very esteemed, and finally, Raymond, partner with RedChalk, a very prominent and active IP brokering, IP banking firm based in Chicago. We're very lucky to have these three panelists with us today, and hopefully we will all enjoy and be enlightened by their comments as we go through it. And then finally, just a quick piece on Pluritas. Many of you may not have heard of us, but we are a firm that's been around since 2002. We've done more than 100 IP transactions on all sides of the transaction landscape, the buying, the selling, the enforcement, the syndicating. We're very active, so perhaps that's why Joff invited us to help moderate the panel also. So with that, I just want to set a little bit of context for the conversation today. Three quick slides, then we'll turn it over to the panelists. First, in talking about best practices and IP transactions, the factors that I think are really important that are being balanced nowadays are, how do you optimize your portfolio? This comes back to, do you really need 35,000 missiles where 3,500 will do? You know, that sort of philosophy. So how do you balance, how do you optimize your portfolio from a standpoint of its size, its quality, its coverage areas, and so forth? Getting a little deeper in on assessments. I think the assessments in the context of the market, understanding the motivation of the other side of the transaction, these are important elements of understanding the full context of a transaction that you might be entering into and can help really help you facilitate a good outcome for all parties. And then, obviously, as part of that, understanding the assessment, understanding what it is you're transacting and why, whether it be on the buy side or the sell side. It's the valuation component, which I think is the most critical. And at the end of the day, perhaps the most challenging in today's market. We heard from the panel earlier today, the investment bankers, the panel about the whole Nortel $4.5 billion valuation. Well, as a byproduct of that, what I've seen in the market, and I think perhaps the panel will echo it, is the Nortel comparable valuation, quick back of the envelope, that now permeates through the boardrooms. You know, everybody thinks that if Nortel could get $4.5 billion for their portfolio, well, then our portfolio should be worth whatever percentage of that based on simple arithmetic of how big it is, perhaps, in comparison. And that's a huge challenge that we all face because really the devil's in the details, as we like to say in the United States. And back to that. No. Yeah, devil's in the details. It is all about understanding the fundamentals of the portfolio. So trying to move away from a conversation in the marketplace and with the boardrooms where they try to take a first blush effort at it using the Nortel comparable and grounding people in reality of what the portfolio really supports. That's an important part of the conversation, we like to think. And then, you know, another important context that we live in today is the pressure that's causing all this interest. It's the pressure to generate profits, operating capital. How do you smooth out that cash flow? How do you deal with tax implications of it? How do you trade off the today versus tomorrow? These are the increasing complexities that we're going to have to navigate through as IP transaction professionals. And lastly, in terms of the setup, talking about the trends going forward, which is really the motivation for the panel, because I think we're all going to be laboring under these kinds of trends in 2012 going forward. It's the question of, okay, what is the optimum composition of our portfolio? What should we be cashing out, selling today? What should we be cash flowing, enforcing, or licensing? What should we hold? What should we be buying? How much cash to allocate for acquisitions for these kinds of opportunities? Should we be working collectively in some cases for whatever the motivation might be, protecting the freedom to operate or other, call it competitive advantage or leverage perspectives? And as always, the first movers are going to gain the advantage. So the people here in the audience are part of the, call it the emissaries, to help potential first movers seize the opportunity. There's a bit of a, call it a fallacy of composition that will go on in IP transactions. The first movers will gain the advantage. Those that come later will pay the premiums and or be in a world in which the IP will have proliferated and the advantage that you can gain from some of these activities. Yes, the financials may still be there, but some of the strategic leverage may have gone away over time. So how do we help our companies, our clients, wrap their heads around this and really take that first step and become a first mover in their respective industries? So with that, I want to turn it over to Charlie, who's going to take us through his presentation.
All right, great. Thank you, Rob, and thanks everybody for coming to one of the last three presentations of the day. I'm going to start out with the provocative statement that cash is not always king, particularly from an operating company perspective. And that's the perspective I've been asked to represent, a large multinational product delivering operating company. And as we all know, different IP owners use IP differently. If that black box is the universe of IP owners and the orange circle is operating companies, inside that is a smaller circle, a subset of that, which are large operating companies that do products, and inside of that is HP, which is a $130 billion multinational company. You all know that. We have products all over the place. Generally speaking, you know, as the IP guy at HP, we look to IP for purposes such as defense of core business operations, freedom of operation, and most importantly, to help grow our business. And I'll talk about that in a minute. It isn't principally a generator of cash, per se. It's an indirect generator of value for shareholders, and I'll talk about that. Many, many companies have exquisitely good licensing models that are baked into their strategy, Qualcomm, Dolby, and others. At this point in time, HP isn't one of those, unless you count software licensing, obviously. But, as Rob mentioned, and everybody here who gets to answer to an executive committee and a board knows that there's pressure on us to explain or help people understand how it is that we believe we're deploying this asset optimally for shareholder value, long-term shareholder value. And so when companies are in distress, we see that they resort more and more to generating cash from IP. And at ultimately, of course, you'll see either a large sale or a wholesale divestiture of their IP portfolio. This is, in my view, mostly an error signal that the company is, in fact, in a fair amount of trouble. Now, it could be that you've left a business or you bought a business and you want to sell some stuff. Those transactions happen. But very often, my first thought when somebody's trying to do a big portfolio transaction is either you're already in bankruptcy or you're in a lot of trouble. And you don't have to look very far to see Kodak and Nortel, and AOL was under a ton of pressure from Starboard, I think. So, and of course, NPEs, and I have many, many friends in that community, that their model is based on monetizing for cash, and they've got to make a decision whether to do an immediate transaction and get an infusion or whether to do an annuity-style transaction through a licensing motion. Same question we ask ourselves at HP all the time. We tend to prefer annuities. More predictable, it's top-line revenue rather than other income, and my business unit partners prefer it as a better way to offset expenses. Big transactions go to the balance sheet, right, as opposed to the P&L of my most important business partners, the executive vice presidents. there's a quote on Rood said that a business strategy without an IP strategy is not a strategy. The corollary is an IP strategy that doesn't serve a business strategy is also not a strategy. And so for any one of us in this kind of role, we've got to understand the particular posture of our employer and craft the responsibilities to craft an IP strategy that advances that, supports it and advances it. So for HP, and I'm not going to pitch HP here, this is one slide on what our posture looks like. We're an infrastructure company. We sell things, hardware mostly, printers and PCs, networking gear, servers, storage. 70% of our revenues come from those, virtually every country in the world. And those tend to be a little bit of a soft underbelly when it comes to patents. We have a fairly significant software business. I think if it stood alone, it would be in the top five in the world based on revenue. We have a big services business. Those are designed to couple together with the infrastructure we provide, cloud, that kind of stuff, to generate customer-centric solutions. We're a customer-oriented company. right? Revenues are a result of a company like ours and any operating company continuing to meet customer needs and exceed them. They'll pay you for that. When you stop doing that, cash certainly becomes king because your customers are no longer giving you revenue. You got to find other sources. You're looking at your assets, right, to monetize. And you'll change your business models. And we just heard Rude talking about what happened to the first entrants into the wireless space, how they did not win. They lost the competition. Later entrants were outgrowing their ability to organically manage the IP, and so they created this situation that we're in today with the Nortels and the InterDigitals and things like that. This is a slide that I use with executives at the company. Actually, I've obviously edited it, but to help them understand how we think about using IP and to get their feedback on it. So at the bottom, the bedrock of this is what's the company's business strategy. If any of you are in my role, you can find yourself being frustrated when the business strategy is sort of surfing around and porpoising a little bit because IP strategies need time to unfold, years often, right? Certainly long periods of time. And if the business strategy is going to veer off course and I have to chase it with my IP strategy, we're going to be in a disadvantaged situation. So we are usually at the table when business strategy is being discussed and developed. It's imperative that an IP professional be sitting there with all the business people. And I think it's imperative that IP professionals be business people as much as IP people. The foundation on the bedrock here is the orange bar, which is having an IP strategy that serves the business strategy and then doing a good job of portfolio management. Organic acquisitions, pruning activities, and management of the portfolio, decisions about where in the world to file what, why, and so forth. And I want to talk about the three concentric circles. I'm always having to balance in a company like ours, and everybody does, but our balance will be different from almost any other company. You know, gaining the maximum advantage we can from our IP while not incurring undue risk from the activities that I undertake. Right? And the goal is, my reason for being in existence, right, at least professionally, is to maximize the total value that we capture from the IP portfolio. That's not always cash. In fact, it's really not cash most of the time. The number one priority we have is to grow the business. I told you HP is a customer-facing product, services, and software company. That's where almost all of my effort and my team's effort are focused. How can we use the IP that we have in our portfolio to advance business growth? Business growth is code for I'd like to grow revenue or margin, or I'd like to sustain margin, or I'd like to enter new categories, or I'd like to enter new markets and regions, right? And IP can often be used in ways that make it much easier for the company to enter a new market, a new category, or to sustain, as many of you know, to sustain margin, like on, well, let's just pick ink, for example, a favorite topic for all of you. And there are a lot of ways to do it. We do a lot of licensing here, you know, licensing partners, ecosystem licensing, a fair amount of hybrid deals where we do trademark, patent, and technology licensing, making HP intellectual property available to partners who are going to build out an ecosystem and make HP's offerings more attractive overall. Occasionally, we can do a patent sale in this space that is interesting. For example, if an important customer or an important supplier or partner is being molested by somebody and they might need some assets in order to help with that problem, we can do something for them, and I would consider it strategic. It keeps a customer happy. It keeps a partner able to continue shipping me chips or glass or whatever it is, right? But rarely are patent sales going to be used there. The second most important imperative is freedom of action. For a company like ours, to the extent that we can help create situations for the business unit leaders to freely compete in areas of strategic interest, we do so. There are a lot of ways to do it. Patent cross-licensing for a company like ours is a fairly significant activity. But So is holding on to patents, and there's a real tension here because we have a very large portfolio, over 30,000. Having a large portfolio has a significant deterrent effect, at least as to other operating companies. And so you like to keep some powder dry just so people who might be tempted to make trouble sort of think twice or even three times. So freedom to operate for us is a very valuable asset to the businesses. It's hard to price. And, you know, we were talking earlier with Raymond about what was the real value of the Nortel portfolio, and was it the creation of freedom to operate without molestation and to be able to sustain margins as opposed to any kind of direct cash generation? Yeah, probably, right? That's why those guys acquired that portfolio, in my view. It almost has to be. A third priority, and one I don't mean to say it's not important, and we do quite a bit of this, is to generate cash from our intellectual property. Again, generally those motions are around standards, trademark licensing, technology deals, and typically they're in the strategic context. So of the IP income that we generate in my shop, a good three-quarters of it is a consequence of strategic licensing motions that we did. We wouldn't have done them just for money. We did them because we needed somebody to make, for example, we needed somebody to make paper for us in a particular part of the world to our specifications using our technology, put our trademark on it, and make sure it's available in the market so people who want to print with HP printers can use the right paper, right? We do some patent licensing. It's pretty small. We do a lot of technology. Patent sales in recent history have accounted for single-digit fraction percentages of the IP income we bring in. So I think that, you know, there's conclusions on the slide, and then there's a few things I'll say. For me and for all of you, every IP owner is uniquely situated. It's not possible to cookie cut it. I don't think it's possible to just build templates for how to monetize. My view is you've got to understand your business. You've got to know who the customers are. HP has a lot of large customers. Many of our customers, I mean, they pay us $500 million a year, right, for our services and products and our software. I need to know what the state of the relationship with those customers is. I need to be in touch with the account general managers. Same with our suppliers and supply chain. It's critical to us. I can help if I know what the situation is. I need to know who the prospective customers are that we'd like to do something with. Can I bring some technology or IP into a deal that differentiates us and separates us from other people who are competing for that account? We've been pretty successful there as well. So the flip side of that is I can't afford to antagonize a customer by selling a patent to somebody that's going to bring it against that customer, right? So I have to be very careful because I really don't need the CEO of a Fortune 10 company calling my CEO, Meg, and complaining about some nuisance that they're dealing with in part because we were promiscuous in letting a patent go. That's not always true, but we need to always manage those conversations. And typically, I'm going to give that customer a shot at it, right? It's like, you're first. You're a big customer. Want it? If not, okay, fine. No problem. So those are the kinds of things we always have to be cognizant of. And for somebody like me and my team, it's like 90% of what we have to do. We have so many customers and suppliers. The relationships are so dynamic. And then you got to figure out how can I weave IP into the story and make HP or any company differentiated, have a better product or service, more compelling to the customer, build a stickier relationship so you're not as substitutable. Okay. At the end of the day, we sell a lot of patents, or at least we put on sale a lot of patents. And so back to cash is king. You know, you're asking, what does this have to do with what Rob said? by the time the patent gets down to where I'm ready to sell it, there's a good chance I've used it one way or another strategically for the business. There's an even better chance it's been licensed through cross licenses. And then when I'm getting ready to sell it, I'm going to preserve for myself the ability to use it. I'm going to preserve for myself the ability to spring a license into existence for any of my customers and important suppliers, right? And so then what has to happen is a dialogue with prospective buyers about what's the value of that thing. Because they're usually pretty encumbered. Not always. You know, sometimes we'll do an acquisition, we'll turn around and do a patent sale without too many encumbrances. But for us, that dialogue, you know, I have to explain this, and it's not hard to explain. I have to explain this to executive committee members and my CEO, right? This is what we're doing with your IP. And while I can't talk about any specific deals with you, not really, I can obviously talk about very specific deals with her, name the customer, name the circumstances, and generally there's a EVP from a business unit right there, right, backing me up. So for us, those of you that are in large operating companies, this is your burden. You have to know your business. You have to recognize that, you know, if you want to start playing the cash for patents game, you're going to have to give one of those other things less emphasis. That's not a bad thing, right? And if HP's circumstances shift, that might well happen. It may well happen. And I got a lot of assets to make cash from. But for now, I just say, you got to be, if you're not in the strategy meetings with the business team, if you're brought in later, then you're in trouble. You're responsible to craft strategies, but more importantly is explaining them. Because I think we've heard all along, you know, IP is still kind of arcane, and it's tough for executives to figure out what you're talking about. So you need to, like, make a house slide or some other simple slide to help people understand it. And then finally, as I mentioned, sometimes there's a trade-off. You know, if I do a patent cross-license, especially a broad one, then I'm diminishing value in the other two dimensions. I won't be able to use those to differentiate products against that cross-licensee, and the sale value goes down. We have to always show that. In some cases, as I mentioned, there's some terrific synergies. I'm going to go do a strategic licensing deal. That partner wants to do it. They want the trademark. They want the technology. They want the patent license. They're willing payers, right? And they're going to build an ecosystem for us that we just either don't want to or can't afford to build ourselves. So I think what I wanted to do with this talk was give you a sense of what somebody in my role, and I think Rude is in a kind of similar role, and Marshall's been in a similar role too, how I've chosen to play this and how we generally tend to think about these things.
Thanks, Ron.
You bet.
So next up will be Beatrix, but before Beatrix comes up, I'm going to switch it up a little bit because I have one question for you, Charlie, and I know I'm breaking already our guidelines about all the questions came in advance, but this is one which I'll try to provide you in a way which will, if you can choose to think about it if you want to before answering it, or just answer it. Because your situation is a market leader situation where you have a lot of ecosystem responsibility. There's a lot, as you said yourself, the need to be able to protect all the members of your ecosystem and license them and leverage them. It's sort of, frankly, a unique position compared to some of the positions that other companies are in, you know, many of the attendees here. So you have a special overriding need to protect your portfolio. But in the situations where that need isn't there, and nowadays in the market you can go out and you can essentially check out a book. If you are threatened by another company against which a patent would be useful, you don't have to have it and pay for it and maintain it on your shelf. You can go to an IV, you can go to an RPX, you can go to an AST, you can go someplace. You can get what you need. So in that situation, can you envision companies then doing this sort of optimization if they don't have as much of your need for the protecting of the ecosystem, all that deep cross-licensing and so forth? Yeah. Would you be an advocate then?
Yeah, so a couple of things. One, despite the fact we have that very large portfolio, sometimes business growth outpaces the ability to organically develop it. So we do work with the parties you mentioned, at least most of them. And we're talking to almost everybody because it would be irresponsible for me to insist that we only craft an IP strategy that's organically grown or organically based. It just can't, in today's world, it just can't work. It would be suboptimal. So then the questions become, look, do I need ownership or do I just need license right? What do I need here, right? And then once I've got it, what are my options for flipping the asset if I've got what I need and I'm done? So those conversations happen all the time. As you can imagine, you know, the company is in a lot of disputes, you know, patent disputes, just because of the breadth of the offerings that we have. So we're constantly in that circumstance. It's something we do pretty well. Yeah.
Thanks. Beatrix?
Well, my world is different, really, totally different from HP. We are not in a company in bankruptcy, but we are using our IP in a totally different way. I'm going to explain to you how we use it. Doesn't mean that we are not manufacturing products or so, but our business model is really, maybe that's why we were chosen, by the way, to be on the same panel, totally different from HP. So first of all, a few considerations about the current marketplace. For me, it's frenzy. I don't know, we discussed that earlier before you arrived, and some in the panel think that the prices are not extravagant. For me, they are extravagant at this point. Of course, these extravagant prices are limited to a certain market, but we hear more and more companies which are really interested in monetizing their patent portfolio. They don't necessarily have a good patent portfolio. They may have a patent portfolio which is useful for protecting their products, but it may have no value for others. I think that we have reached a point when this trend should calm down and we should come back to the real world where patents are assets. They are certainly important assets, but they are not assets which have, which are reaching each the price of an artwork like it's a small one here on the slide, but the Scream for Munch from Edward Munch was sold for $120 million dollars a few weeks ago. Nobody expected that price. So now a lot of companies think that they have patents which are worth this amount at least. And that's why I like to compare the current IP marketplace to the art marketplace. Absolutely unpredictable and uncertain. Difference between big companies and small structures is that in a big company, you have to follow a lot of processes for approval of either a sale or an acquisition. Not for our current business, which is licensing, but if I want to purchase a patent portfolio, I have to go to an investment committee, then the investment committee asks questions, challenges my presentation, says, well, you should answer this and this question, and the result is usually that the patents are sold before we are able to make a decision. So at least the small structures like the NPs, they have all liberty to freedom to buy patents much more quickly, and it's probably a reason why they are much more active in this market. I would like to caution also everybody, even if we hear a lot about the average price of a patent, that doesn't mean anything. All patents have very, very different value. You can have patents which have absolutely zero value. You can have patents which have the value of the cost for filing and maintenance, and we can have patents which have really huge value. We have seen that in the past, but what I want to say here is that it's not because you have a patent portfolio that it's necessary a wonderful patent portfolio. Now let's discuss a little bit our patent licensing business model. Well, we are not keeping our patents for ourselves. Of course, we use our patent portfolio primarily for protection of our products, because we manufacture products, for all our strategic purposes, for cooperation, partnership purposes, but we use it for monetization. Our business model is that we license all our patent portfolio. We don't keep any patent for any other purposes. We don't keep any patent for competitive advantage. We have been in this business for many years. RCA started licensing in the 1950s with the Japanese industry and transferred the technology plus the patents for helping them to build their TV industry, which worked very well. So we give full access to all our technologies to our licensees. When we sign a license agreement, it's for, let's say, 5 years, usually 5 years, and the licensees have the right to use all our patents on the products which is licensed. For example, TV, which is still a product, even though it was very long ago that it was invented. So when they sign the license agreement, they have access to patents filed before and patents we have filed during the term of the agreement. We license an end product. We don't license the component or the technology. Of course, there are exceptions. We are licensing, for example, MP3, which is a technology. And we are also part of the MPEG-2 pools, which obviously are doing technology licensing. What do we do? We don't present to our licensees all our patent portfolio because it would be a bit long and complicated, but we select a certain bunch of patents, those which we have marked, as we say, which we have determined are used by the products of our licensees, future licensees, and we present them to the licensee, and we convince them that usually we convince them that they are using our patents. So all this to explain to you that for us, selling a patent is not that easy. So if we sell a patent, what happens? Well, this patent is potentially licensed. So we want to be fair to all our licensees. And it's very difficult to extract patents from our portfolio because those can cover features which, even if they are not used in the TV now, they will be used in the future. And the licensee has the right to use them. So it diminishes the interest of selling our patents. And we don't want to have third parties to which we would sell our patents to go against our licensees. So what we can do is sell the patents which are orphan, what we call orphan patents. They are not potentially used in any of our licensing programs. So we have a few of them, but not many. And also, when it is the end of a licensing program because the products are expired or are not used anymore in certain geographical areas but still exist in others, so we can sell the rest of our patent portfolio for those products. And we also think that we have a reputation of licensing under fair, reasonable conditions and in an amicable way. And if we sell our patents that are used aggressively by NPE, for example, then this will not help our reputation. And we are very, very fond of our reputation, of course. On patent acquisition, so We love to do patent acquisitions. That's not always very easy because, as I told you, the approval process is very long, but it has happened. We have done that with patient companies which were willing to sell us their patents. Well, there were, I think the process for selling on their side was the same as the process for acquiring on our side. So finally, we made it, but it was long and complicated. So when we acquire a patent, we will use it, of course, for all our purposes. And why do we want to buy patents? So to complement our current licensing programs, an example is that we are no more in the display business. We used to be in the LCD, for example, business. Now we are no more. So, of course, the patents which we filed many years ago have a trend to expiring a bit too quickly. 20 years is often not enough. But what can we do? So we purchased a patent portfolio on LCD, for example, a few years ago. We also like to acquire patents to launch new licensing programs. And that's, of course, for monetization purposes. We can do that in different licensing technological fields, where we don't want to compete against our own programs, but we can launch complementary programs. We are also agent for third parties' patent portfolios. The current example is OMSD. It's a laser diodes applicable in DVD and Blu-ray players. And we are also now licensing agents for patent pools, Premier BD, which is, as the name explains, applicable to BD, BD disc and BD players. And what I call limited pools is not a pool, but we have put our patent together with those of Fraunhofer, and we have had a very, very successful licensing program on MP3. So the competitive environment in which we are, we are competing for purchasing patents with a lot of companies. First of all, the trolls, which compared to us, as I already said, have a big advantage of flexible and reactive structure. They can make decisions very quickly. And they are leveraged by venture capital, and for us, it's not always easy to get cash from our management. Patent aggregators also are kind of competitors because they take the patents out of the hands of the trolls and license them to the users of those patents, and the corporations which want to gain market share or protect their own products. Now, what are the major trends and risks? Well, as I said, the current prices are very, very high, so it's not easy. I know that if I go to my management and ask for $100 million for one patent, well, I know the answer. So I usually don't dare to do that. And we have been exploring lately a lot of potential purchases and decided that it was not worth being kicked out of the management, by our management of the executive committee room, so don't do it. What I find very often is that prior commitments are very difficult to find out. The selling company is ready to sell its patents for a very high price, but they don't want to give any indication on prior commitments. The patent, which is already licensed to the whole world, has obviously very little value, while a patent which is not licensed at all has a very high value. Also, the SI mentioned is very often obscure, very, very difficult to find out. They say that the patents are owned by them, but how can they prove that? Usually it's very difficult to find. Some brokers have also a tendency to tell us, well, if you don't buy this patent by such a date, the price, it will be sold already, so you have to hurry up and so on. What we call the deal fever. A lot of brokers are doing that. And now we are facing something which is quite new for me, at least, what we call the springing license. I mean, when you grant a license or a non-asset to a company in another deal, they absolutely want you to transform this license into, well, this limited license into a license for the life of the patents when you sell them. So we try to resist, but I don't know if anybody in the room is facing that, but it's extremely disagreeable, and of course we don't want to accept that. So my opinion is that the market should become more reasonable, and I hope as soon as possible. So as a consequence, for us, patent acquisition deals require speed, cash, of course, but creativity. And here, well, I'm not going to explain that in that length because I don't know if I have been. I still have time? No? Well, anyway, Charlie, you took my time already, so. So what is attractive in our business model for sellers of patents is the fact that we can do revenue share. So we can, when we buy a patent and we include it in a licensing program, we can, of course, pay a fixed payment. Usually the seller wants a fixed payment, but also add to that the fact that we are going to share the revenue from the licensing program in question, and usually our licensing program is successful, so it's good insurance for the seller that they will have a return on sale. And often we combine fixed payments and revenue share. Well, I'm not going to discuss the rest because this is, I think, very normal in the market. So I'll just leave that to you if you want to read it. And thank you.
Thank you, Beatrix. And again, I actually have just one question, Beatrix, if I may. Given that current prices are so high, when you do find a winner in your mind, something that you really do want, how do you go about justifying it with management? I mean, sort of, is there anything that you find they're really looking to you for in terms of that something extra confidence, or what is it they're looking for you to, you know, put your stamp on it in order to make the cash available to you?
If I can demonstrate to my management that the patent will never be invalidated, that it's perfect, that it can sustain all litigations, I'll win. But at this point, I dare not, as I said, go to the management these days.
Okay.
For if I find one patent which has an extraordinary value, because a patent can always be destroyed in a litigation. Just a question. Now you have even some companies, which are here, in this room maybe, which help you destroy the patents of others. So if it's only one patent, I don't buy.
Okay. Got it. Thank you. Raymond, please. And
thank you, everyone, for the opportunity to speak here today. I know that we're all at 5 o'clock at a beachfront resort, so thank you for your time and your patience. And I'll try and be insightful today. I'm very different my firm is very different from HP and from Thomson. Sorry, Technicolor, excuse me. And in that, we're advisors to large corporations on the topic of IP. And oftentimes our work is around a portfolio. It does involve valuation oftentimes. And in this context, we're trying to help really put in perspective some of the things we're seeing from many of our clients and trying to present that to you. So what are some of the market observations and trends that we're seeing? Obviously, as IP awareness in the C-suite has increased, and I'll talk a bit about what we're seeing that's not new to this audience, we are seeing an increasing use in buy-side programs, and it's not always about telecommunications and wireless. We're seeing a shift in the seller mindset, actually something that Charlie alluded to earlier. We're seeing an evolution in buyer consortia, so groups of companies coming together to make purchases. And I also want to talk a bit about valuation trends and talk about this point of the pricing of patents today. And yes, we're going to discuss Motorola and Nortel. So the C-suite. What's been interesting for us over the last, I would say, 12 to 18 months is that CFOs are increasingly in the discussion, and in many cases, starting the discussion. And that's new. And the reason that's happening is they're seeing the valuations, they're getting more questions from their shareholders, and they are now oftentimes coming to the IP organization and asking the question, what are we doing with our portfolio? CEOs' expectations have been raised, whether correctly or not. And what we've seen in the U.S. is that's particularly acute in medium-sized companies. Companies who in the past have never really had to address this issue are now getting asked from their shareholders, what are you doing with our IP? They're seeing transactions like Motorola and Nortel and saying, we have wireless patents. And as Beatrix mentioned, people incorrectly think they have the best patents in the world, and therefore they're all worth $1 million each. So they have to answer this question now, and more often. The shareholder awareness of IP, especially in the U.S., I assume in Europe as well, has really increased dramatically. And the one example I have is at dinner with some family friends, and there was a grandmother at the table talking about the Google patent portfolio. And that just shocked me. It was eye-opening. And then the other point, which many of us have talked about, is financial innovation is really continuing to drive this, what I call market liquidity. So driving a lot of the topic, there's cash coming into this space, and it's driving a lot of questions and attention of IP in the boardroom. So overall, the C-suite is engaged more, which we know, on IP-related issues. And the IP function is now being viewed by many different lenses, including the grandmother who wants to know about the Google IP portfolio. So first, about some buy-side programs, and I call them strategic because what's new, I would argue, from our perspective, is that companies are setting aside budgets and teams to acquire IP. 5 years ago, 10 years ago, that wasn't the case. Maybe they were thinking about acquisitions, but they weren't setting aside budgets necessarily. It was usually on an ad hoc basis. And this is large companies and some medium-sized companies now. They are actually setting aside dollars and budgeting for IP acquisitions. And they're realistic budgets, too. So in terms of buy-side programs, I want to talk about the activities, it's pricing, and the channels. From an activity perspective, driven by many multiple factors, the one thing I could say is they're not typically driven by current litigation. In the past, you may have seen fire drill efforts to acquire patents as for defensive purposes, but now it's not driven by that. And then where the competitive landscape is changing very quickly, there's a need to aggressively augment your portfolio and fill gaps that may not have existed even 6 months ago. From a pricing, and I've shared this before, there is an hourglass model for the patents that are considered very strong litigation quality. You're looking at $500,000 plus typically. There's many patents in the middle that get sort of squeezed, and then at the bottom you have patents that are typically not very valuable. And of course, this is only applicable to the 1 to 2% of patents that actually are valuable, so it's a subset of the entire patent market. And of course, the economic models are focusing on assertion value or discounted cash flows. Channels, clear preference for large companies to go direct wherever they can, or use an intermediary like us in some cases to provide some anonymity in the transaction. So the seller mindset, and what's shifted, and Charlie alluded to this earlier, there is a shift, I would say, from cashing out now today to a cash flow perspective. Again, the CFO is now in this discussion. So having an annuity stream, even for a couple of years, wins, and they would prefer that. And we're seeing many potential sellers, these are corporations, put that forward on the table, because we want to see some kind of an annuity stream, something up front plus some annuity stream, even for very basic transactions. So again, the desire from corporations to shift this IP transaction from a one-time event to recurring cash flows, and I would argue even for very simple transactions with a handful of patents. consortia. Obviously, the hotel was discussed at great length over the last 2 days, a very unique situation. But what we're seeing, if you think about the reasons for a consortia or a group of companies, there's a pooling of shared economic interest, a pooling of shared strategic interest, sort of who participates, and hand-selected group. This is now a realistic option for smaller transactions, less than $10 million of size, and as long as the costs to set it up and implement it are low. And there are entities emerging with business models in place to really support those transactions. So that, I think, is going to be one change we're going to see over the next probably year to two, is more of these entities coming up on a needed basis to support these very specific consortia purchases for, let's say, smaller transaction amounts. Valuations, we talked about it briefly today, they're driven by IP quality. That's fundamental. If you think about market comparables, for example, public data or even broker transaction data, that's obviously confidential to many people. You may have auction data. You may have some other public data, for example, Google transactions, Nortel transactions, et cetera, or other things you may see in the journal. But the pricing is driven by quality and the tranches of quality. So clearly you have gems that are clearly the best in your portfolio. It's usually a handful of patents. You're talking in less than 1% range of your portfolio. Litigation quality, licensing quality, inducements quality, and then nowhere to low value. So what happens, and I think some of the examples that were discussed, is that this pyramid in many sellers' minds becomes inverted. As all of a sudden, my portfolio has nothing but gem quality patents, all worth at least $1 million. That's the problem. So when we encounter that as a potential seller of patents for a company, there's a long education process that has to take place. We want to make sure we have someone who's realistic in terms of their pricing expectations. But what I would argue is that buyer-specific value drivers will trump those traditional valuations, and that, I believe, is what's happened in these recent outlier transactions. So you have a traditional valuation, bottom-up, based on some distribution of patents. And what I'll go back to in this slide is on the right, this distribution, the pyramid is a bit of a misrepresentation. As many of you know, that distribution is not normal. The distribution is actually skewed left, meaning most patents have no value. So, again, sort of people begin to think about average prices, and they misapply that across their portfolio. But thinking about traditional valuations, there's a traditional valuation, something buyer-specific, what's valuable to the buyer. Not necessarily you're going to see it on a spreadsheet. Moving these totals higher than you would normally expect. What are those value drivers? Blocking power, pricing premium, purchasing power, many of the things that Charlie mentioned, product synergies, increases in market presence or brand value, royalty rate balancing, royalty avoidance. My point is that those can eclipse the traditional valuation in some cases, and they can be unpredictable and very difficult to model. So what are some of these value drivers based on buyer type? Because now you have to think about these value drivers differently based on who is going to be buying. So thinking about these value drivers, look at the different types of buyers. You have market participants, new entrants, and NPEs. This is a lot to digest. I'm going to go through it quickly. Feel free to come up with me afterwards and discuss. But if you think about market participants, people in the market today, what's very important to them is blocking power and pricing premium, I would argue. For new entrants, it's a little bit more. It also includes purchasing power and royalty rate balancing. For NPEs, what's, of course, important, especially in an assertion context, is blocking power. And, of course, many others don't apply. But the point of this slide is to recognize that these drivers have a different importance to different types of buyers. So you need to know who the buyers are and what's motivating them. Thinking about new entrants, and here I'm going to transition a bit to some recent transactions, what we would stress is that they were very buyer-specific. And this notion of is there a bubble, we think sort of misstates the case. We would argue that, in fact, the valuation of what the price was paid was what those companies were willing to pay to reach their perceived value. And I would argue that, yes, it's clearly an outlier in terms of historical norms. So historical pricing or benchmarking for, let's argue, higher, medium to higher quality patents is around $100,000 U.S. That comes from, I believe, IAM magazine, I think, last year. And look at Motorola and Nortel, $500,000 per patent, $750,000 per patent. There's clearly a gap, 5 to 7 times. And people's perceptions begin to become skewed based on these examples. Well, it's very important. We have to remind our clients is that these are very large, cohesive portfolios relevant to large markets, hardware, software, cross-wireless standards, IT infrastructure, and there are numerous standards and central patents. So that's a bit of a unique situation. You can't apply to every transaction. So new entrants want to acquire aggressively, often bidding against each other, sometimes leading to irrational bidding behavior. And smaller market participants are also adding fuel to the fire. So to conclude, I mean, pricing is not done in the abstract. I mean, it's done by people like us in the room, working in front of spreadsheets based on intuition, based on market knowledge. And we would argue that whether or not the pricing will persist or decline is really dependent on many variables. But, you know, we feel that it's fundamentally determined by the size of any unmitigated liabilities and the revenue opportunity in a given market. So in other words, you can't generalize. Thank you.
Thank Ray. That was very nicely done as well. And just one observation. So it sounds like the key to a good sale program is to target new entrants. That's my takeaway from your presentation. But also, a question for you about the CFO's interest in cash flowing, because we've also heard that same statement be made. And it seems to be quite prominent in the current time that we're in. So do you envision that as payments on a schedule as their preference, or do you see that as possibly more of an inclination to be open to back ends on enforcement, or what is it you think that translates into?
Let me answer your first question by saying that we want all three types of buyers to be bidding on a portfolio. What we're typically seeing is a mix. We're certainly seeing, just last week we had a phone call with an operating entity who specifically said, we want an upfront payment plus a back end. And they didn't know who my client was, and it was not an operating entity. So in this case, it wasn't going to work because this wasn't an NPE looking to make some kind of a longer term play. So again, it's about educating my clients, the potential seller about my client and their interests. But we have also seen the case where it's very clear that they want an annuity stream over time, and they're not going to move from that. And so in a certain extent, it's those buyer behaviors that are driving that in the marketplace. My impression is that the fact that it's coming up is not driven by operating entity behavior. It's really driven by some of the NPE activity.
It's a provocative point. I mean, as the C-suite comes in, one of the biggest issues with patent transactions is the lumpiness of them. And so obviously, as the C-suite comes in, the first question the CFO wants to address is how to make them predictable. So this is very, very provocative, very interesting. In the spirit of the intention of the panel, in terms of its topics that we were set out to embark on by Joff and IAM, I wanted to ask maybe one or two more questions and then turn it open to the audience. Talk about a little bit about best practices and valuation and portfolio assessment, if we could. So if the panel could comment on what is the key to good valuation in terms of valuation that adds value to the transaction versus possibly gets in the way of a transaction getting done. And what are the pros and cons of getting very detailed, not going so detailed, also perhaps about how you might use the valuation with the other side of the transaction? So in terms of best practices around valuation and how it's helped or hurt making the right decisions, the right transactions come together, some approaches on that, could some of you perhaps comment on what you've experienced on valuation?
Sure. It's really all over the map, Rob. Part of it depends on the size of the transaction. Part of it depends on the distance that the parties are apart. For example, in a very, very large transaction that I did a couple years ago, the parties were hundreds of millions of dollars apart. And at the end of the day, we decided to hire brand name valuation shops, right, to come in and help kind of I don't know if mediate's the right word, but help guide a conversation to an outcome. And we got there. I won't necessarily credit the valuation guys who ultimately ended up reflecting their clients' perspectives principally. We have a valuation center of excellence in the company. And so for small to medium transactions, we're pretty confident in the valuations that we do. And we generally don't move. I'm not that keen to move outside the parameters that we set when I set the approval for the deal. And so, you know, sometimes you just gotta be willing to walk away. But you know, almost all these transactions are one-off. And so the valuation is always going to be unique and always going to be a debate, almost always going to be a debate between the parties. My preference is that we air it out. You know, my preference is that we share our spreadsheet. It's like, here's how we got it, right? This is the forecast. This is the royalty rate data, this. And then we can argue about facts or argue. We can debate those facts, massage that around, and so my preference is always to lean on facts or, you know, what as close to facts as one can get in these kind of negotiations. So, and, you know, parties who are bargaining in good faith get, I think Rob's right, at some level they get to the right value. There are distortionate effects. Auctions are one way to create distortion. But I think the right value, as long as you can keep emotion out of the transaction, gets arrived at most of the time by parties.
Thank you.
For those parties.
Anyone else?
Yeah, my experience is not that different from Charlie's experience. For example, if we purchase a patent portfolio, a few patents, to complement one of our licensing programs, we evaluate ourselves what is the plus which we can get from this portfolio as compared to our current portfolio. So, and we have expectations, so we can set value to this portfolio. Of course, the other party will challenge that. They want more. But if we really want the transaction, we'll find a middle point. And sometimes it doesn't happen, but it's always done on a case-by-case basis. There is no real general rule.
The one thing I wanted to add, and I certainly agree with what other participants have mentioned, is that especially where we've had transactions where we're selling assets for clients, for a client, and we've had multiple types of buyers interested, NPEs, market participants, new entrants, what we've seen now consistently for a couple of large transactions is that the valuations that come in, when you get close to reservation prices from all of these players, end up being very tightly bound. You can tell they're all using similar data. They're all using very similar spreadsheets and assumptions in their models, and they're all coming very close to the same number. And it's usually at that point where maybe a bit of the irrational behavior or someone's desire to really get it comes in to move beyond the spreadsheet. But we've seen that now, and I think it's interesting to me.
Thank you. One more question on portfolio assessment, then we'll turn it over to the audience if we can. Let's now talk about best practices in portfolio assessment and the blending the use of corporate resources versus external resources. You know, one thing that we've seen a big trend in is hiring outside law firms to do assessments on positions. And we've also seen these law firms want to add value in how they assess and how they present back a risk profile of a position, which is not always enhancing to the deals getting done in the end. So just that's maybe more of a judgment comment, if I might. But I'm curious your perspectives on how the portfolio assessment is done in the best way possible, using inside resources and how that decision gets made, and leveraging outside resources, and at the end of the day, making the right decision on whether or not to go for a portfolio or to divest a portfolio and so on.
Well, when we purchase a portfolio, we usually do our own analysis because we are equipped for that. We have the right people for that, so it's very rare that we go outside because going, as you said, going to a law firm may have may put more importance on risk, as you said, that on the real value of the portfolio. So it's, or they will try to make you believe that it's much better than it is. So we prefer our own assessment anyway.
I can just add one point to that, which is for large transactions, we've been engaged as a second set of eyes in a secondary valuation. So I think clearly the internal teams provide a number, and they oftentimes will want to have it checked by an outside resource, at least to see if the general range is correct.
Yeah, I actually agree with both of you. We rely on our internal team. When there's a materiality to it, though, it's in our interest sometimes to have a brand name, third party, give a look, create a document that survives audits and stuff like that, right? So for those of you that have public disclosure responsibilities, you got to know what's going to be material, and you got to be alert to it. So we do employ brand name shops occasionally to gloss a deal and make sure that we didn't miss something really bad. And to paper some stuff over, right, just to make sure it's good.
All right. Well, how about questions from the audience? Please.
I think we have a good track record on licensing, so it's probably easier for us to convince our management to invest in a licensing program, because we are good at what we do, rather than to acquire a new business, which we have made the experience of acquiring a lot of new businesses many years ago. And it proved not to be very, very good. We acquired at the time when the prices were very, very high, and we had to get out of a few of those businesses. So thanks to our credibility and track record, I think it's easier for us to convince our management.
Mr. Potter.
Yeah. Huge amounts of cash have been spent basically on technologies which were being produced in the mid-90s, I guess, in the case of the telecoms area. Would any of you care to make any comments as to where the new large sums of cash are going to be spent on new areas which are coming in? Is it going to be mobile advertising? Is it going to be something else? Have any comments on that? Go on, Ray.
I'm not a financial analyst, so I'll just give you my personal opinion. Some of the trends that we're seeing certainly indicate that wireless health or e-health is an area where, at least from a patenting perspective, it's getting very interesting, and you're seeing a convergence, almost an extension of some of the telecommunications and wireless activity going forward. It's just one person's point of view. I don't know if it's going to be accurate, but we can meet next year and see if I was.
Well, I'll add just one thing, Stephen, because we're also spending a lot of time talking with folks in Wall Street, and they are really actively trying to be the emissaries to the C-suite about the changes that are coming. And I think they recognize one thing as a pattern that they can seize on, and that is stumbling existing players, new entrants. So I think the comment was made before about new entrants, and Rude made it earlier. And that transition, both from a, you know, the new entrants from a geographic perspective, and then also a change in technology and the market power perspective, they are all locking in on that, and they are inspecting the various different markets, looking for exactly those sorts of characteristics and starting the conversations. So eventually what will happen is those portfolios will slowly get freed, and then as they become available to the new entrants, there will be the buying interest. So at a meta scale, that will start to heat up certain ecosystems, and then within that, there might be more activity within that ecosystem. So it's almost looking market by market for those kinds of transitions.
You're talking about the kinds of business situations which are involved. My question is really more around the kinds of technologies and technology and market areas.
Sure. So, but I think a little homework, I mean, a little homework in some of these situations will uncover that. Go ahead, Sean.
So I'll go out on a limb, and I think that I think we're going to see, you know, there's a gigantic secular trend around medicine, right? It costs too much. It goes up too fast. We'll start to see more and more personalized medicine, point of care, remote monitoring, chronic disease management. And, well, I'm not going to talk about pharmaceuticals because that's a whole, you know, molecules are a different game. You know, the medical device industry is very destructive of new entrants. Companies start, they go away. It's an industry that tends to be very keen about IP, even at startup phases. They have a different DNA. And so I don't think 1 year is enough time to determine whether or not my prediction's any good. But 5 years from now, there'll be, I doubt if there's a medical device company representative in this room. But I bet you there will be, because those are going to be some really powerful patents and technologies. They're going to change the world, and they're going to change the way we live. So much like wireless did in its way, my prediction.
Another question from the audience? Yes.
No, not really. I mean, if you're talking about a buyer of the asset and acquirer, you know, again, I'd go back to the it's every deal is unique, it's individual, the encumbrances matter, but formulaically speaking, I just don't know that I could put anything together. When you are using an asset in a licensing program, though, you know, you're building a database of what the asset is worth, and so we can, you know, we can typically converge down to what we believe is a sustainable outcome. Many of you have done deals where you got a really nice deal, and then a year later, your licensee is making refusals to pay and trying to figure out ways to renegotiate and all that. I don't really enjoy that too much, so I tend to aim for what I believe is a sustainable relationship. We want happy licensees. They're usually partners of some kind. So once you've been licensing an asset or a cluster of assets or an area for a while, you really start to know what it's really worth. And so that's probably the best answer I can give. It's not a great answer, but.
Yes.
Mark Wolfworth from BCG. Beatrix, on your last slide, you mentioned something about tipping value of an asset. And I'm just curious what exactly you meant by that and how you think about the value that you can get, you know, or licensees can get from your assets that is kind of helps tip their product businesses.
Yeah, that's difficult to answer. This is a case-by-case basis as well. So it depends really on the licensee and the patent. So I cannot give you a real answer on that either. It's very difficult. Sorry.
Maybe offline. More questions from the audience? If not, I have one question, which is maybe a little bit more of a philosophical question or sort of a crystal ball question. You know, the implications of cash being king and portfolio optimization is, you can call it a lot of loose intellectual property floating around in markets, which maybe were quite stable and happy being stable, but now that things might shake up a bit. Any comments or observations about the implications of this as we play it out? A good thing, a bad thing, business as usual, or cautionary words, predictions, anything about that?
Well, I can just repeat that for me, the prices now, contrary to what Raymond thinks, are extravagant, and I hope it will not last forever, because I would like to be able to purchase patents at a reasonable price.
Amen. Amen.
Since I'm in the business of making predictions suddenly, I'll make one. When, you know, if IP is an asset class, if it's going to become a mature asset class and get traded like a real asset, it's going through its adolescence maybe right now. You know, initially you had an asset that was either closely held, very thinly traded, right, usually held for defensive purposes. You start to see some loosening of that, and you get what I call distortionate behaviors earlier. You get speculators. You get a lot of people adding transaction costs because they're intermediating themselves, right? Ultimately, of course, in every real market, liquidity, the ability to hedge, create derivatives, and much more rapid transactions with much more transparency begin to take place. Parties get disintermediated. And so for those of you that are in the business of making money from transactions that some of us do, be aware that my prediction is over the course of years, systems will come into place that will try to disintermediate or commoditize you. If that doesn't happen, then IP is not an asset class, right? It's just a unique good of some kind. So, again, I'll go out on a limb. Maybe 4 or 5 years from now, we can have a talk. I would imagine Raymond has a much more informed view than I do on this topic.
Do you want to say something on it? Okay. Well,
which he is not willing to share.
Please stop by afterwards, and I'll share my thoughts with you.
Okay. Well,
no, I'm just kidding.
If there's no further questions, last call, because drinks will be waiting, I suppose, at the pool. I guess IAM is buying. I want to thank our esteemed panel. I want to thank all of you in the audience for coming today. Thank you very much.